I'm Brian Ellison, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. We're 3 days into the new year, and we want to know, what resolutions have you made? Today, we'll look at the age-old tradition of setting goals at the start of the calendar year. If you're determined to be a better you in 2018, we can offer some tips for making and sticking with a plan. And if your resolution is to stay as fit as Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, well, we've got the inside scoop on how she does it. But first, we'll go back to American history class. There's sure to be some George Washington, the Civil War, the pioneers. But what and who are missing from those lessons, and who decides what gets taught? We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Every kid in high school, every college student's going to learn some history, and every American school will teach some American history. But what history? Whose history? And when something's controversial or uncomfortable, when facts are in dispute or conclusions about those facts differ, then what's a teacher supposed to do, and what history are today's students missing out on? These are questions unfolding in classrooms every day, and we're going to bring that conversation here about the challenges of teaching history. Joining us are James Liker. He's a professor of history, chair of the department at Johnson County Community College. Professor Liker, welcome.
Thank you.
And also Ben Jewell. He teaches history and also debate at Lee Summit North High School. Mr. Jewell, glad to have you here.
Thank you very much.
So this isn't a new conversation about how to teach history. It feels like it's an important one given the times we're living in, though, not only because we have a president who is making history, shaking up assumptions about American history, perhaps, but also because the competing media narratives, the cries of fake news, it all has the effect of making us question the information we receive about, quote, historic events. So let me ask you both a very basic question. How do you decide what to teach? What's the guiding principle for what makes it into your history lessons? James, go ahead.
I think every college instructor has to make that decision for him or herself, and a lot of the answer they're going to provide to that question is based in their own training and what they see as particularly important. So for myself, being a Kansas native, I think it's important that students have a good grounding in the local so that they understand the provincial setting in which they currently live. But also, they need to be aware of the role of the United States in the larger world. So on a daily basis, I'm always making decisions about where does the United States fit into the big picture, and simultaneously, how can I bring that home to them in Overland Park or in Olathe.
And does that feel like a very subjective personal judgment on your part?
All the time.
And there's no way around that.
Well, there are certain objective criteria that I think every history instructor is required to follow. But within that, there's an awful lot of room for latitude.
Ben Jewell, you teach at the high school level. Is it any different for you?
Well, what's primarily different about teaching at a high school are the state standards that exist. And so those are always a very interesting debate because they're politicized. Mm-hmm. And then quite often they change. So like if you were to travel back in time just a couple of years, there was a debate over whether or not the state of Missouri should adopt the Common Core. That debate really didn't happen at the public level. It happened amongst people that the governor had appointed. They did. And then the legislature got in there and said, no, we don't like that. Let's get rid of that. Let's write our own standards and have a little bit greater debate about that that involves, you know, experts and lay people. And then, you know, in the public high school classroom, then it filters down and then we get to decide how we orchestrate that curriculum.
Well, and that's sort of my question is how does it filter down really? I mean, you're describing conversations in legislative chambers and committee rooms, but when it's you and the history teacher sitting in the teacher's lounge talking about what you're going to teach, or you in the privacy of your classroom, how much does that really matter?
Well, it often matters in terms of shaping, but you're right. Like, there's a sense in which every time that I walk into that classroom, I'm sovereign. You know, I can talk about whatever I want. I can put it into the context that I want. You know, I'm the biggest filter, you know, of the curriculum. And so there are, you know, ways in which you design, you know, what you talk about where you're trying to take the real world that these kids are living in and communicate something about the past that has an immediate connection. And that can change, on a daily basis. It can change because of conversations that you have with your colleagues. We do live in a target-rich time when it comes to trying to figure out
in terms what of you might hard focus questions on. Right. to answer. Another factor that obviously must determine what you teach is what's in the textbooks that you use, which I imagine you have some discretion about books in your classroom, but not total discretion. Is that fair to say?
In my department, we have an approved textbook list, and we give instructors a lot of latitude in being able to choose from it. The market for history textbooks, at least at the college level, and I would imagine at the high school as well, is very competitive. We've got textbook representatives in our classrooms all the time or in our offices all the time. I think there's more of a move in recent years for college instructors to be moving toward teaching primary sources directly. Mm. A textbook is nice because you've got a big, thick secondary source that's been provided for you by somebody living now who can explain it in contemporary language.
Your preparation is a lot less if you have a textbook.
That's correct. It's easier for the students, and a lot of ways it's easier for the teacher. One of the goals, I think, of good history teaching is to teach them how to be their own historians, to have that experience that's going to carry them through life when the teacher's not there. Yeah. And to do that, they need to be able to grapple with primary sources themselves.
But if you're using textbooks that, as you say, are sold by publishers, commercial operations that are trying to sell a book, that's giving a lot of power to people whose motivations for selling their book may not be the same as your motivations in how you want to educate students. Is that true, Ben?
It can be. There's big debate in the last 20 years about how state standards sometimes guided some of those books at the high school level, and you can still read in
The California standards or the Texas standards,
correct.
And then everybody else has to follow them because they buy so many books.
That's right, and Texas in particular, because they have standards for high schools. California doesn't, so they. In the case of California, they used to designate a lot of what happened at the elementary school level or the middle school level, not so much at the high school level. Texas, on the other hand, had, I think, a great deal of impact, maybe until the mid-90s. And what you began to see in the mid-90s, I think, was a kind of a shift towards, and partially because of history education and the kinds of teachers that were being produced by universities, to have a more inclusive narrative everywhere, and to include primary sources, and to teach kids more techniques about investigation of historical sources for themselves, how to understand secondary sources that are more complex. And there's been a real shift away from the kind of supremacy of a textbook in even a high school classroom. Since I started teaching in the 90s, I don't know that I've ever used a single text.
Really?
And
that is a change from what I remember about high school, for sure.
It definitely is. It's sort of an obvious change given the way that media has so transformed in the last 20 years.
You don't have just one evening newscast or one newspaper in town. You have all of these sources of news.
Well, not only that, but if you have a question about, what date was that? You can say, hey, pull up your phone and tell me right now.
You don't need the textbook for that.
No. And you can do that in all sorts of ways.
We're talking about how American history is taught and learned here on KCUR's Up to Date. I'm talking with Ben Jewell, who's a high school teacher at Lee's Summit North, and James Leiker, who's a history professor at Johnson County Community College. We want to talk with you, too. How well do you think history is being taught and learned right now, whether that's your experience or your kids' experience? Are you concerned about what's being missed? Join the conversation at 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888. We've laid the foundation for sort of how, in a nutshell, history education takes place in American classrooms. I want to dig in a little bit to how it is not always coming through, or what is not being taught. You've already alluded to sort of the controversial or the difficult issues that come up, that and the autonomy that you have as teachers. Are there certain subjects that you think risk not being taught or not being taught well in American classrooms today, James?
I think history of the environment is getting more attention, but it's been sorely neglected. Women's history is starting to get more attention, but it's also been sorely neglected. Probably the one area that we've seen the most progress in is that when I was coming up through the ranks in the 1970s and 80s, the Black Civil Rights Movement of two decades earlier was practically ignored. It was not considered part of the grand narrative, and today it would be unthinkable for any high school or college instructor to omit that part of the teaching.
Why do you think something like, let me come back to the civil rights movement, why do you think the environment is something that is not being taught?
Well, in the early 1970s, of course, there was a lot of emphasis during the years of Nixon on trying to clean up air and water pollution. The Cuyahoga River actually caught on fire in Ohio. I think as we're seeing the phenomenon of global warming and we're starting to understand man's place within a much larger ecosystem, it's inevitable that you have to tie human-based history into how that is affecting nature.
And yet it doesn't always happen, you're saying.
No, and I don't know that that's because of anything malicious on the part of the instructors. It's just that some people just don't know how to do it properly. It requires some interdisciplinary grounding in the physical sciences and so forth. Well, but that's just one example.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good example of something that perhaps there is consensus in certain academic communities about, and yet something like climate change, you know, that does – Ben, I'm thinking you're in Lee's Summit North. You know, at times you're going to have some families who would object to your teaching the history of climate change in a particular way.
That's probably true. I think that the notion of studying how the environment changes in American history classrooms at the high school level is so much more difficult too, because there's just so many other things that you have to cover. So if you go to a university, you'll get a catalog of classes. Yeah, there are, you know, maybe say 15 or 20 classes offered, and there's somebody there who's an expert on that.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, the point that there are expertise issues at the high school level. It's true. The other end, though, that I think that where it could be introduced more often at the high school level is the notion of how the land has changed in the United States, which is something that is not well covered in American history textbooks, but is something that is easy to emphasize over the, you know, the course of an American history course that any student might take.
James, you mentioned the civil rights movement as an area where you it would be unthinkable for it not to be taught in today's classrooms. And yet, I wonder, is there consensus about how to teach about something like race and the history of race in America at this point?
Oh, not really. Of course, when you bring up the topic of race, we're talking about more than just the African-American experience. And there's a wide range of opinions as to what the legacy of the Black civil rights movement was really all about. But part of the problem is in injecting all of these different sub-histories into the larger narrative, you come back to the problem that Ben identified. What do you leave out? For every suggestion of what needs to be included, there should be an equivalent suggestion of, okay, well, what's not so important that we can omit that and make room for something else? And that's where you make those hard rubber meets the road decisions at the daily level that you never really know if you're making the right decision.
You may only have a semester or two
right
to do it. Kelly in Leawood has called us at 816-235-2888. And Kelly, I know you wanted to mention something about how you think civil rights is taught in classrooms.
Sure. Hi. I was just wanting to comment that we acknowledge the civil rights movement, but we don't really acknowledge the role of white America in why that movement was necessary. For instance, how segregation became so embedded into our culture, especially in a place like Kansas City, where, you know, J.C. Nichols revolutionized the restrictive covenant, which led to blockbusting and housing segregation. And just, I think that that's a big piece that we're missing in education, especially in suburban America right now.
And Kelly, let me ask you, I mean, you have gained some insights into some of the nuances or what the civil rights movement failed to accomplish, it sounds like, but or what we don't learn about the role of white people in reinforcing segregation. But where did you pick it up if it wasn't in the classroom?
Well, I picked it up when I was in law school. I took a critical race theory course and wrote a pretty extensive research paper about the topic, especially in Kansas City specifically. That's how I learned it, sort of a personal initiative.
Yeah, and I appreciate that very much. Kelly, thanks for calling in.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Ben Jewell, I want to ask you, I mean, obviously there's going to be a lot of ideas and counter ideas and reflections on those ideas when you get into complex issues, including the civil rights movement. How do you handle that as a teacher when you can't possibly teach everything there is to teach, but you don't want to leave anything out?
Well, I mean, I think the first thing you do is you choose sort of what perspectives you want to emphasize. You know, in a very basic sense, take the civil rights movement as the example. You know, do you talk about the leaders? Do you talk about the movements across the country? Do you talk about how it was responded to? What primary sources do you choose for that? And then, you know, trying to figure out how your students are going to respond is sort of a fool's game. And so, you know, your job as teacher in many ways is to select those perspectives which you think are going to bring the most understanding, and then to figure out how it is that you bring a classroom of people to a kind of, not consensus, because all history is contested, and people really relish their opinions about, you know, how it affects the present. But
well, and it's, you know, they relish their opinions, but it's also parents who are deeply concerned for their children, and they have these strong feelings because they want to convey a view of the world to their kids.
Well, and that's, you know, the classroom is, especially a high school history classroom, can be the first journey outside of the haven of the ideology of the home, let's say, and the history of race in particular presents so many intricacies and is, you know, so contested. But, you know, it's only been in the last 30 years that you can talk about it, and so that has really transformed the way that that classrooms operate. And I think that, you know, first, to go back to the J.C. Nichols example, that's something that I think is much more a part of, I don't want to say common knowledge, but, you know, it's much more a part of education and curriculum now to explain how the systems that were designated by segregation transformed.
Let me talk to Bill in Overland Park. Hello, Bill.
Hi. Thank you. I read a book several years ago called Lies My Teacher Told Me, and I want to say the guy's name is Joseph Ellis. But it, basically, it took 12 textbooks, high school textbooks, and sort of dissected them of like, okay, these three got it right in this area, but not in this area, mm-hmm. and this one chose to focus on this. You know, so I'm just curious, as a teacher's perspective, you mentioned source teaching to source material, which I think is great.
Sure.
And so how much of that do you run across in your day-to-day?
Our guests both nodded when they heard you mention the book, The Lies.
Yeah, that's
Lies
James Loewen's book. Yep. James Loewen's done some remarkable work on sundown towns and the history of race in America. And that book, Lies My Teacher Told Me, has been commonly accepted, I think, in the academic community.
Oh, I used to use the first two chapters as the introduction to my American history course,
so that kids understood what they have to, how to read critically,
right,
and understand
right.
those things. Is it fair to say that there are quote unquote lies that are sort of in the conventional wisdom of what's
being
believe
taught? In giving people the benefit of the doubt. Occasionally, yeah, outright deceptions do happen.
Like what?
Well, for example, the notion that slavery was a civilizing institution. It wasn't that long ago. In fact, you still see some textbooks today which claim that slavery uplifted Africans out of savagery and brought them into a much better place. That's ignoring, you know, mountains of evidence and primary sources to the contrary. But more often than not, I think, there is a certain ideological agenda sometimes in the way textbooks are written, and it goes back to something that Ben was pointing to earlier, in that for many of us, history is a way for parents and for countries to instill certain values in the younger generation, whereas in an academic setting, the goal is to encourage children to question those values and to form their own educated opinions. Mm-hmm. And so this is why I think history is such a contested arena, is because you've got that collision of interests that are happening.
This doesn't happen with math so much.
You could probably find some math teachers who would disagree, but I would say yes.
Fewer lies by omission in math.
Let's talk to Ara in Grantville, Kansas. Hello, Ara. Are you there with us, Ara? Looks like we've lost her. How about Gabby in Kansas City, Missouri? Hi, Gabby.
Hi there. I just wanted to say that in Australia, we in senior history tend to concentrate on world history with Australia's place in it, which gives a much better history of the world and where we all fit in rather than concentrating on America. I'm not knocking America, but it seems a better way to get a grasp on world history rather than what happened in one country.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point, Gabby. James, is it true that we Americans are a little more focused on America as America?
Oh yeah, I would say that's no exaggeration. The enrollment in world history classes has steadily gone on the uptick in the last decade or two, and I think it's a good trend. I don't know that the United States is all that unique. If you go to France, you're going to take the history of France. If you go to Britain, you're going to take classes in the history of Britain. But I think the more innovative approaches are trying to move away from that nationalist model and to show that we're really one human community. And so all of our histories are intertwined.
Ben Jewell, when you teach history to high school students, I mean, do they have more interest in American history? Is it hard to get them to see America in the context of the rest of the world?
Well, I teach it. A curriculum is called International Baccalaureate.
Right.
And so it's comparative for all of the Americas. And so they get a grounding in some history of Canada, some history of Mexico, some history of various places in South America, and also the United States. I think because the culture is so ensconced in the notion of trying to create a meaning for kids as Americans, mm-hmm. and this is why American history is taught from the grade school level on, that by the time they get to high school, there is a kind of predilection for it. There's a comfort there, because when you're trying to learn about another culture, and I think, if there's a big blind spot in American history teaching, it's that we don't emphasize whatever it is that American culture is, or how to break it down and analyze it. And so students get into high school, and when they're faced with these other cultures, it's sometimes difficult for them to gain an interest quickly.
Let's take one more call before we go. Klaus is calling from Platte City. Hi, Klaus.
Yeah, hi. One comment about teaching history, of course, there are so many things, but local history can turn into world history really quickly when you, for instance, show how slavery and cotton growing affected other nations, too. But I wanted to make a different point. I taught history in Germany and here in the United States, and I must say I was kind of appalled that the history books here were more or less destined to glorify the nation instead of showing what really happened. And I could give a lot of examples. In Germany, it was different because with the experience of the Third Reich, of course, we were compelled to give an unattenuated look at what happened. So I wanted to know, and I taught history in the 90s. I quit teaching in 99. Has there been any progress ever since, or is it the titles at that time, Our Glorious History and whatever, are they still a vote?
Yeah, great question, Klaus, and that's a pretty harsh assessment that the U.S. Compares unfavorably with post-war Germany and how it talks about its history.
Yeah, I'd like to say there has been progress. I'd really like to say that. My training...
But you're not sure you can?
I'm not sure I can. My training requires me to look at these things themselves historically. The whole notion of public education in the United States is less than 200 years old. Before that, only elites studied these kinds of subjects. One of the trade-offs that had to be made for the history of the United States to be taught in a taxpayer-subsidized system was that history was designed as a tool for assimilation, to teach recent immigrants that this is what the country stands for. Again, it's about inculcating value. So there's always been this connection between nationalism and the instruction of the past.
Very quickly, Ben.
Yeah, so it's absolutely correct. And I think that, it's public education begins in Boston, and it's a way to invite people into the American community. And so it's about indoctrination in a way. And American exceptionalism is something that is very difficult to avoid.
The idea that America is somehow different by divine right or something that from all the other countries.
Manifest
in the world.
Destiny.
That's what makes the teaching of world history so hard, because you don't start from that assumption of American exceptionalism.
That's correct.
That's James Liker and Ben Jewell. James is head of the history department at Johnson County Community College, and Ben teaches history and debate at Lee Summit North High School. Thank you both so much for being with us. When we come back, it's the new year, which for many of us meant making a new commitment to healthy eating or exercise or good choices of some kind. But what helps us actually keep those New Year's resolutions? There's science on this. We'll hear about it when we come back. I'm Brian Ellison. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. Welcome back to Up to Date on KCUR. I'm Brian Ellison. In for Steve Kraske. Yesterday, we talked about the biggest religious stories from 2017, including why President Donald Trump was the religion newsmaker of the year. You can hear that conversation and more at kcur.org. And tomorrow, for years, babies born and given up for adoption in Missouri couldn't get a copy of their original birth certificate. That changed this week. We'll talk about what that means for adoptees and the people who gave them up. Plus, we'll have a conversation about IDs. That's tomorrow on Up to Date. But today, millions of Americans and many of you, dear listeners, rang in the new year by making resolutions. Alas, it's already the third day of the new year, so for some of you, it's too late because you've already failed to keep them. But for the rest of you, there is still hope. And as it turns out, there's some sound psychology behind making and keeping resolutions, some good tips for achieving that healthier, saner, more responsible lifestyle. So today we're talking with several guests who have a little insight into how people do this well. Dr. Ayelet Fishbach is a teacher of behavioral science and marketing at the University of Chicago. Dr. Fishbach, welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
So you've been researching New Year's resolutions for a while and recently published a paper. Let's check some of our assumptions. What do people tend to make New Year's resolutions about?
Health. A lot is about health. Another category is career goals. That takes a big chunk of what people are planning to achieve this year. And then there is all the idiosyncratic stuff, spending more time with my friends, developing myself in some special ways, and so on.
So something like half of all of the resolutions are related to health. Did you also research how many people actually keep those resolutions?
Not many, at least not in full. By March, we see a huge decline in keeping resolutions. And I would say that most of us don't quite stick to our resolutions by the end of the year. We kind of forget about them.
Well, it's nice that we at least feel bad about it, I guess. What seems to determine success in whether a person successfully keeps a resolution?
Now, the important question, how to make a resolution that one can actually stick to it. And what we find is that the way to go is to basically plan something that is at least somewhat pleasant to pursue, at least somewhat fun. I would say that the one mistake that people make in planning New Year resolution is that they plan to do something that they would basically consider suffering through it.
Resolve to eat more broccoli.
Yeah, and you really don't like broccoli. So, you know, don't resolve that. Okay? You will not eat something that you hate.
But if you enjoy it...
So there must be some vegetable that tastes good for you. Pick that one.
All right. So you're more likely to be successful if you actually are going to enjoy fulfilling this resolution.
Yes, and the psychology here is pretty simple. The person that I'm going to be in the future is awfully similar to the person that I am in the present. And given that my present self would like to do things that are at least somewhat enjoyable and tasty and fun, that should also be the plan for my future self. So yes, eat healthily, exercise, but find the healthy food that you like. Find the exercise that is actually fun to pursue, or add music to it.
Well, we do want to hear from you, assuming you've made it to January 3rd. What is your New Year's resolution, and how do you plan to actually keep it? Why do you think this time it will really happen? Give us a call at 816-235-2888. You can also tweet at us. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Again, the number is 235-2888. You just heard from Dr. Ayelet Fishbach. The majority of New Year's resolutions are health-related, and so we've brought in two experts in areas where we know many of you want to improve. First up is Brian Johnson. He's been a personal trainer for 28 years, but all you really need to know is his number one client, Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. In fact, he's the author of The RBG Workout, and he's joining us this morning by Skype. Brian, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
We're glad you're here. So I'm going to digress from New Year's resolutions for just a second. How did you end up as Justice Ginsburg's trainer?
Word of mouth. I actually work at the federal court as a records manager. I was training one judge, and another judge told another judge. And then when Justice Ginsburg was recovering from colon cancer, her husband actually looked at her and said, "You look like someone that just came out of a concentration camp. You need to get stronger. You need to get better." So she reached out to one of the judges who I was actually training in. That's how it started, by word of mouth.
And so she's apparently pretty strong now.
Yes, much stronger. Her workout is much harder now than it was 20-some years ago when we started.
I have to admit, looking at the illustrations in your book, which are all of Justice Ginsburg doing these exercises that you recommend, I can sort of hear NPR's Nina Totenberg's voice saying, Justice Ginsburg, how many reps? Mr. Johnson, just 12 more. Justice Ginsburg, grimacing, more weights. Mr. Johnson, leaning in, you go, girl, you can do this. Is it something like that?
To be honest with you, I have a funny story. I remember Nina, she was asking Justice Ginsburg about the book. And she says, do you really do everything in that book? And the justice response was, in this case, what? Of course I do. How dare you?
In distaste. I love it. So anyway, for people who aren't Supreme Court justices who are resolving to get in shape through more exercise this time of year, what's the short version of your recommendations to them? What should they do to really stick with it?
Why do you want to do it? Be honest with yourself and ask yourself, why do you want to do it? And then once you realize the reason why, then start off easy. Stop trying to do too much too fast.
Give me an example. So if you want to do it because you want to look better or feel better, does that change what you would then do to stick with it?
Well, no, as long as you're honest with yourself. If you're doing it for vanity, then it's like, okay, then I'm doing this for vanity. And then if the reason why you're doing it for vanity, after you do it for a couple of weeks, you realize, well, you know what? I don't really care how I look anymore. So then you go by the wayside. But now for Justice Ginsburg, for example, hers was health reasons. And so because it was health reasons, she took that a little more to heart because it meant helping her to live a better quality of life.
So how do you encourage people to keep their resolution to work out? They've had that honest conversation with themselves. They know why they're doing it, but still it's hard to get that workout done.
Yes. And then I try to do it. I like to kiss it. When I say kiss it, I keep it simple for success. What are you doing? Let's just start off easy. The book is simple, easy, and effective. I always have an acronym for everything. And so if you can't do everything, then just do something or just show up. Just walk by the gym, look in. Okay, do that on a consistent basis. Now walk by the gym, go inside the gym, come back. You have to be consistent with anything that you do.
We'll ask you to stay with us here, Brian. We want to bring in one more voice, and joining us here in the studio is Sarah Ingersoll. She's a nutritionist at Truman Medical Centers. Sarah, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Working out, getting more fit, that's one resolution that's very popular, but so is eating healthier. A lot of people say this time of year that they're going to make a change. Do most people try to make a wholesale change in their diet, or do they try to just take on some little thing?
I think with New Year's resolutions, we really see people trying to make big changes. So keep it simple. I really like that acronym, KISS. I will definitely use that.
He said it so nice. Keep it simple for success.
Yeah.
He didn't use stupid in that spot. That's good.
Yes, but people do tend to try to eliminate whole food groups or go through the process and try to do too much at once.
That's not a good way to do it?
Exactly.
Why not?
So whenever you try to do too much at once, you're setting yourself up to fail. If we start with specific small goals, we can change those, and then we can build onto it. Another thing to think about is weight loss. Weight loss goals are a big thing that you see, but really if we try to change the healthy habits, a benefit of those goals that you're setting for your New Year's resolution will actually show weight loss.
I guess I'm wondering how successful people are at sort of flipping that switch, at saying there's something I was doing before, something I enjoyed doing, eating this particular part of my diet, and then as a New Year's resolution, saying I'm not going to do that anymore. How successful are people at that, really?
I've read a few articles recently about statistics and New Year's resolutions, and one of them was about actually going to the gym and saying that only 10% of people stuck with that goal. So I think that it's about the same for other goals. So those people were just trying to do too much too fast and didn't stick with their plan. The same with healthy eating. We really have to plan ahead, think about what we're going to prep for the week, if we're going to the grocery store, making the list and sticking to it. Also thinking about what we want to change one thing at a time.
I want to, again, invite our listeners, if you've had a New Year's resolution in a past year that really stuck or at which you really failed, if you want to share that, give us a call at 816-235-2888. What are you trying to take on and how's it working or how did it work? How did you make it work? 816-235-2888. We'd love to hear from you. Ayelet Fishbach, you deal with all the psychology of different kinds of resolutions. I'm curious, is there one trick, one tip that you would give to someone that if they're going to make this work, that will help them find success?
So we already heard about a few. I like the idea of setting realistic goals. Okay, so something that I know I can do. I already suggested make it fun. Make sure that this is something that is going to be pleasant to pursue. Other tricks is include to create an environment in which this is more likely. So if I want to eat healthily, where am I going to get the healthy food? Who's going to eat this with me? Social support is a big one. Okay, who are the people that are going to help me get there? So if you plan to exercise, can you find someone that would be fun to go to the gym with? There are a few.
Yeah, those are all good ideas. Brian Johnson, are those little tricks, do they seem to help for people?
Those are excellent tricks. I like the part about having fun. One of the problems that I have sometimes is people go to the gym and they just get overwhelmed by the amount of equipment in the gym. And they don't know what to do, so they do whatever seems to be familiar. Start off easy. If you don't like going to the gym, then go for a walk. And then as you start doing something consistently, then you start to add and adjust and change. Add something different. Maybe go for a walk, then stop, sit down on a bench, stand up 10 times. Guess what? That was 10 squats.
And there
Moving
you are.
Moving on. Yeah.
Yeah, we had a comment on Facebook from Tina. She said her resolution is to be completely debt-free by the end of the year. She says, in November, I connected with a business mentor and an accountant. We made a written plan based on current income, leaving room for early payoffs when her business solidifies. This is an example, Ayelet, of a non-health-related resolution, but it sounds like Tina's well on her way.
As you were mentioning this, I'm just looking at our data, and I said that about a third were work-related, financial-related. Actually, 20% were planning to get out of debt. So, a very common New Year resolution. And for this one, really, it's about making the specific plan. The general idea of getting out of debt is... is good as a starting point, but how exactly this is going to happen, who's going to help, at what pace am I going to make progress with this? Laying out the plan is going to make it much more likely goal.
It's not one where you can say, well, here's a way you can do it that's really fun. There are some resolutions that are just maybe not fun.
Well, the thing that is hard about getting out of debt is that it's about not doing something. It's about not spending. This is also something that we often see that is hard about dieting because this frame is not eating something. So that not doing are usually hard. However, I can think about ways to translate the not spending money into doing something else. Okay, so maybe spend more time with my friends. We had the idea of walking. Maybe do more of walking and less of shopping.
816-235-2888 with your New Year's resolutions and how you plan to keep them. Wesley is joining us from Lee's Summit. Hello, Wesley.
Hello. Just wanted to make a quick comment. It's not necessarily a New Year's resolution. I just made a resolution to eat healthy because fear of getting cancer after my mom died. And so I resolved to change my entire diet to eat healthier organically and, in fact, live everything organically. And the biggest hurdle I would say I had to make was the taste. I could eat cereal for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and I went to eating organic soups and everything, and I'm still struggling with the taste, but I've made it to where I like it. But I still don't love it like I dips with cereal.
How long has it been that you've been keeping this resolution?
It's been about 2 years now.
Wow. Congratulations, Wesley.
But I will tell you on the positive, I feel great. I sometimes I wake up and I feel like I'm 25 years old, even though I'm in my 50s.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I appreciate your sharing that story. And let me ask Sarah, our dietitian guest, about that. Sarah Ingersoll, how typical is Wesley's story? He decided, I'm going to change my whole diet. I'm going to eat organic. Had some trouble with the taste, but eventually it's come to work for him.
I think it's becoming a really popular movement to try to change things all at once. And I do think that eating organically can be tasteful with adding extra herbs and spices to those. So that might help you out, Wesley, while you're on your journey.
All right. Some good advice for Wesley there. We had an email from Nick. He writes, what are your guests' opinions on using devices such as Fitbits to track exercise and diet and to keep resolutions? Let me ask you, Brian Johnson, is a Fitbit or a similar step counting tool useful in helping you meet your goals?
Yes, because it makes you accountable and you're trying to reach a certain number of steps so you can get into a contest with people in different parts of the state and have a Fitbit challenge. So that is an excellent way of doing that.
So a little competition, if that works for you.
Exactly.
You know,
how many steps have you made today?
Well, and I'm always sad when I look at my number at the end of the day, but I'll work on that. I guess I want to ask sort of each of you for kind of ways that people maybe who haven't made that resolution yet, who are thinking, you know, maybe I should do this. Is resolution, it's New Year's, that's why we're talking about it, but is that really the way to go? Is it really good to sort of set one big goal at the start of a year, or would it be better to take a different approach? Let me ask you, Sarah Ingersoll.
I really think it's about better to start with small, simple goals that you can achieve. Another acronym that's pretty popular is SMART goals, so specific, measurable, attainable, realistic, and in a certain time frame. So you could set one goal and give yourself a week to add more fruits and vegetables at each meal. So that could be something that you could test yourself on and then
make a weekly
build from
resolution
there.
Instead
yeah.
of a yearly one. Brian Johnson?
I agree. I like that process. Instead of trying to go to the gym and do everything all at one time, let's just make it. I'm going to try to go to the gym once a day. Maybe I'll do it once a week. You know, make it small, something that you can attain, mark it on your calendar, and then, okay, I've done this. Now let's try it again.
And Ayala Fishbach, is there something about the psychology of a New Year's resolution that is better, or is that actually worse?
It's better. Well, it's a good idea to start everything new when knowing what you are. What do you want to achieve then? What are your goals? So I would say the beginning of the year is the best time to plan some goals for the year, but then also the beginning of the month. And for many people, that's their birthday that makes them think about how do I want to be different now that I grew up, that I'm 1 year older. Any beginning is usually associated with an increase in motivation.
Yes.
So as many beginnings as possible, but New Year's, you know, is one that we share with others. So this is the right time to make a resolution with other people. Let's do it together. That's helpful, too.
Well, we will wish everyone best wishes on all their New Year's resolutions. That was Dr. Ayelet Fishbach. She teaches behavioral science and marketing at the University of Chicago. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Brian Johnson, who is Ruth Bader Ginsburg's personal trainer, and he trained some other people, too, over the last 28 years. Thanks, Brian.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
And Sarah Ingersoll. She is a dietitian at the Truman Medical Center. Sarah, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
On Wednesday's KCUR music contributor Bill Brownlee joins me in the studio to highlight a Kansas City act with an upcoming show. It's our local listen. Bill, Happy New Year.
Same to you, Brian.
What are we going to be hearing about today?
A man named Chris Burnett is a relatively unheralded Kansas City jazz figure, and he just set up a year-long series of engagements at the Black Dolphin, the sister club of the Green Lady Lounge. He'll be playing at 9 o'clock every Saturday night, every first Saturday of the month for the entirety of 2018.
Well, so you can hear him this week, but you get a lot of other chances too.
That's right.
Well, we're going to hear something that isn't the group he's performing with this weekend, but it is one of his songs. What are we hearing?
Yes. Chris Burnett he's a military guy, and he played in the NATO big band for years. And in 1990, he met an Italian pianist named Dino Massa. They made an album together last year, and this song is called Notos.
Let's take a little listen. So we'll keep listening to that, but what does this track tell us about Chris Burnett?
Yeah, Chris Burnett is very proud to be a part of Kansas City's jazz tradition, yet he doesn't play necessarily in that upbeat, swinging, happy style.
Very different than a lot of Kansas City jazz.
Right. The album he made that we're listening to here with Dino Massa is called Echoes of Europe, and that alludes to the fact that Dino Massa is an Italian pianist, but this is what Chris Burnett sounds like anyway, and this is what he'll be sounding like with his quintet at the Black Dolphin.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about that ensemble. Who's playing with him?
Yeah, it's many of the guys you're hearing right now. His wife, who's the flautist, will be performing with him, Terry Anderson. Instead of Dino Massa on piano, it'll be Roger Wilder. Charles Gachet, the guitarist, will be part of the band, Dominique Sanders, and drummer Clarence Smith on most dates.
And this album you mentioned, Echoes of Europe, you reviewed it for KCUR about a year ago. What else should we know about it?
Yeah, it's serene, it's composed, it's, the entire project sounds kind of like this rainy day music in, somewhere in Europe. And it's a lovely project. I highly recommend it.
Well, I think a lot of people will be interested now that you've shared it with us. Thanks, Bill.
Thank you, Brian.
That's Bill Brownlee. It comes to us every week with our local listen. Thanks so much. Our podcasts and previous programs are at kcur.org/uptodate. You can also find us on Twitter. We're at kcuruptodate. And don't forget, follow KCUR on Facebook, too. Tomorrow, we'll look at recent changes in how privacy is handled in Missouri adoptions. Also, a conversation about identification. It's one of those things we might take for granted until we don't have it. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Kathleen Pointer. I'm Brian Ellison, and you are up to date